This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty, welcome to episode 10 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we have former New York Mets announcer and the now voice of the Los Angeles Angels, Wayne Randazzo, joining us. Wayne, thanks so much for taking some time during the All-Star break to come on the podcast. Do you watch the Home Run Derby and the All-Star game, or do you use this time to kind of decompress and take a little bit of a break from baseball?
Kind of both, you know. You have to pay attention and watch in some degree. You know, you have to kind of know what happened, and I like watching the All-Star game anyway. And it's always, I think, been the best sports All-Star game out of the major sports. And I thought last night's game was no exception. I thought it was a fun game. They got to change the uniforms back. It is too distracting.
Yeah.
To see these guys in these generic uniforms. And I think some of the guys are too generic to be wearing the generic uniform,
right.
Which I think is another reason why they should go back. So, but other than that, I thought it was a really good All-Star game. And I think baseball always, it's the closest to its real form when it's the baseball All-Star game. So it's fun to watch anyway. And as someone who loves the sport, I'll always pay attention to that. And, you know, otherwise it is good to get the break and get strong for the post All-Star break schedule.
So yeah, it's about halfway through your first season as the TV voice of the Angels. How did you end up landing that job? Was that something that they approached you about, or did you kind of hear that they might be looking for somebody and you throw your hat into the ring?
I think over the years, you know, you make contacts, and you hope that maybe someday that those contacts work out in a way that turns into something more. And I've kind of known John Carpino for a while, the Angels team president, kind of running around in the same Italian American baseball circles that we are involved in. And so John is someone that I've known for a while. He's from Chicago, as am I. And so it was a good connection that I had with him. And, you know, once the Angels kind of decided they wanted to move into just having a little bit more stability in their TV role, you know, they reached out to me after the end of last season and, you know, said that they would like to bring me in and kind of be their lead TV voice. And yeah, I thought it was a really good opportunity, to just get into a position like that, period, and B, to have it be in that market and with that franchise and around the, you know, two of the greatest players of all time on a regular basis. I thought going in would be really fun, and it's been great. You know, it's been a good role for me, and working with Mark Gubiza and, you know, the crew at Bally Sports West, it's been really fun. So it's been a nice transition, and, you know, Shohei certainly held his end of the deal too, with the way that he's played.
You joined Apple TV Plus during the season last year for some of their broadcasts. You had filled in for Gary Cohen on SNY. You've done baseball for Fox Sports in the past. As great as you were on radio, I feel like it seemed like you were destined to go to television at some point. Was that the goal the whole time?
Yeah, well, I appreciate you saying that. I love radio, and baseball on the radio is kind of where it all starts, I think, for most people, whether it's listening to games growing up or, minor league baseball, that's really the only option or generally the only option is radio. So it's a natural fit, I think, as you get started to think about being on the radio for baseball. You know, as you move forward with TV, every highlight is the TV call. Everything anybody pays attention to is the TV call. And I like doing TV on top of it. I think it's fun to have a kind of a more captive audience in the regard compared to radio, where I think a lot of people are listening, but they're not necessarily just listening. You know, they're always doing something else while they're listening to the radio, whether it's driving or gardening or they're at the beach or whatever. There's another thing involved. Whereas TV, you know, generally you're just sitting there watching the game and listening along with the broadcast team. So, I like both. And, you know, I did feel like TV was just a better outlet right now as things evolve, and especially being with Apple. I mean, to be involved with the streaming option. And as Apple TV gets their live sports brand going, it's great to be on the ground floor with them.
Does being a TV play-by-play announcer, does it feel bigger than radio? Like, I think in most sports, the answer is yes, but baseball, radio play-by-play, the announcers have historically, and they still do, like Howie Rose has such a unique connection to the fan base still.
Yeah, you know, I think in the big markets especially, there is still that, you know, Howie is you know, one of a kind with regard to the Mets. Maybe he's two of a kind. Maybe Gary's kind of the same way. But they know so much about the history of the team. They've lived every single moment the Mets have ever had. So he's a great counter on the radio broadcast to what's happening on TV. If you can't watch TV and you want to listen to the radio, or if you just prefer the radio, I mean, Howie's as good as they get. I think Giants fans are certainly spoiled with John Miller and Dave Fleming on their radio broadcast. And there's a lot of good radio broadcasts around baseball. But I think in the bigger markets, especially where radio still has a hold, you know, there's still is that kind of connection to the local radio broadcast team. So I think TV does feel bigger, even with those teams. I'm sure it does. I think radio will still have its hold on the audience too, and have its place, especially in baseball, for a long time to come.
How's getting to cover Shohei Ohtani and just the chance to watch and call home runs and call pitching performances from arguably the best player in the history of the sport on a daily basis?
I mean, I think anytime you're around a superstar, there's a level of kind of being on the edge of your seat about it from a broadcast standpoint. You know, anytime with the Mets, anytime Jacob DeGrom pitched, you always felt that jolt in the ballpark. You know, with Shohei, it's on just a different level because the jolt is there in some way every day or in multiple ways on the days that he pitches. It's remarkable what he does. It's so unique in the history of any sport, really, to be a two-way player the way that he is. And I think we're fortunate to just be able to see what he does. And I'm even more fortunate to have a front row seat and to kind of narrate it as it is right now, be the kind of soundtrack for Shohei Ohtani's career at this moment. And it's, I don't know how long it'll last, but hopefully it does last a while because it is such a great, you know, ride to be on. With Shohei and the way that he performs, I don't think people really grasp how difficult it is. I mean, think about two starting pitchers in the All-Star game, Zach Gallen and Garrett Cole. They've had great years, and they get 4 days off every time that they pitch to do whatever they need to do to recover mentally and physically. And Shohei will pitch. He'll pitch seven innings. He'll pitch just as good as those guys. And then he's in not only in the lineup that day, he's in the lineup the next day after having that kind of strain on his body. I think he's only missed two games so far this season. It's really just the strength that it takes and to do it at the high level that he does both is incredible.
Do you get to interact with him much being around the team every day? Does he do many interviews for the local broadcast?
Yeah, he'll do some interviews on the post game afterward. You know, Ipe is his interpreter. We saw Ipe at the All-Star game too, as Shohei did an interview with Ken Rosenthal.
Right.
You know, Shohei's around. He's busy, you know, he's always working on something or getting ready for something because he's preparing to pitch and he's preparing to hit. So, you know, there's always a kind of a preciousness to Shohei's time, but you know, more than the others in that regard, but he's available and easy to you know, have some kind of conversation with, usually through Ipe if you need to do so.
How much does he want to win? I think we see that like an infectious smile that he has so often on TV. And it might almost like mask some of his competitiveness, but we saw during the World Baseball Classic that winning is definitely very important to him.
Yeah, you did. And I think he mentioned it this week, too, as he was doing his press conferences and media responsibilities for the All-Star game. It's huge. And why wouldn't it be? You know, he's the top player in the world. He's still pretty young. I think he just turned 29 years old. His birthday was last week. So he's really in the prime of his career. He's at the peak of his powers right now. So, yeah, the next step is winning, and he'll have more control over that once this season is over, whether he stays with the Angels or whether he decides to go to a different organization. You know, the winning aspect of it will be, I think, the number one thing for him. He'll feel like he needs the best fit for himself and a chance to win. And I don't, you know, the money's going to be there. Somebody's going to pay him something. And I don't think he's going to go to a bad situation just because they gave him another $20 million. I think he will pick the best fit for him based on the fact that the teams that are going to go after him are all going to have the money. So I don't think he's going to just go to the highest bidder. Right. I think he will really dissect what he believes is the best situation for how he plays, how he prepares, and who will give him the best chance to be a world champion.
Do you think the Angels are going to look to trade Ohtani if they're under 500 at the deadline? And is trading him the smart move if that's the case?
You know, it's not an easy question because there's so much to it. You know, if you're around the Angels and around Angels Stadium, the influx of Asian fans is palpable. I mean, you see Asian fans all over the ballpark when the Angels are home, especially even on the road, wearing Angels gear, being a part of the organization, being a part of that fan base that I'm sure weren't there before. And maybe some of them will stay, but I would think most of them are there because of Shohei Ohtani. There is a real, you know, having grown up around the 90s Bulls, there is a real Michael Jordan aspect to Shohei and to the way that he is seen from the people in Japan. And I think now from people here too, that he is everything to them, and they will follow him. So you're going to lose a lot of fans if you trade Shohei Ohtani. Now, if you don't re-sign him, that's just the way it goes. You know, he's free to do what he wants to do, but to physically put Shohei in a different uniform, I think is not a great business move. It might be the better baseball move. You know, maybe on the field it makes sense because you don't think you're going to keep him, so you want to get younger players and prospects that can help you win later. I get it, but I think overall, physically putting Shohei in a different uniform just is to me, it's a bad move. And I hope they don't do it. So we'll see how it turns out. I'll understand it from a baseball standpoint if they do decide to move him. But I think considering everything, and Ken Rosenthal made this point last night, talking, you know, with regard to Artie Moreno, he doesn't want to be the guy that does that. And I wouldn't want to be that guy either.
Yeah.
And I think losing him in free agency is a different pill to swallow than trading him.
Yeah, I think typically with star players, you would look to move them if you didn't think that you could keep them beyond this season. But I do think, like you said, if the Angels make an effort to sign him and they just lose him in free agency, fans kind of get that. But if they do trade him to the Giants or the Dodgers and then he re-signs there, and then a couple of years down the road, none of the prospects that the Angels get in return pan out, and realistically, none of the prospects that they would get would ever come even remotely close to being what Ohtani is. So at that point, Artie Moreno might go down as having made one of the worst trades in the history of baseball. And I don't know if that's something that he wants his name on. And I certainly don't think that's something that the fans would accept.
Yeah. Let me think about the Washington San Diego trade with Soto.
Yeah.
Or even the Dodgers Washington trade with Scherzer and Trey Turner. You know, that's kind of more of a comp because you got a great pitcher and a great hitter in that trade. You know, they got good players. I mean, Keibert Ruiz is a nice player. He's turning into an everyday catcher. Maybe he becomes an all-star. Josiah Gray was an all-star this year, and he's become a really good starting pitcher. Maybe the guys they got from the Padres for Soto turn into that too. Gore and Abrams and James Wood is a good prospect. You know, it just doesn't move the needle the way that Shohei does. And maybe they have a sense if they can re-sign him or not. If they believe they have a chance, then they 100% should not trade him.
Does Shohei get enough attention and coverage nationally, in your opinion?
Yeah, he's starting to. I think he really is beginning to. I think he finds himself in places that a lot of baseball players don't. And, you know, I think that is another special quality about how good he is for the game, because he reaches platforms and reaches people that I think that even guys like Mike Trout or Aaron Judge don't reach. So I think the sport itself needs to wrap itself around Shohei. And I think it is. You know, we do so much. We talk about him so much on the broadcast. And I don't think we tell enough of the story globally about how great Shohei is, and really that he is a walking giant and a walking history book when it comes to baseball. Is all about its history, and we put so much obsession over Babe Ruth and Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays and Joe DiMaggio and all that. I mean, there's DiMaggio right there; he's behind me. There's so much obsession with that, those greats of the all-time sport and our national pastime. But we're walking among one right now with Shohei Ohtani. And I think that needs to be told in that way.
Yeah, and I think that always amazes me when I hear people like Chris Russo talk about Shohei versus Babe Ruth, and just so quick to kind of dismiss Shohei as being the greatest of all time. Whereas, like, me personally as a fan, like, I want to say that I was able to watch the best baseball player ever, as opposed to saying I didn't get to watch it and it was, the answer is Babe Ruth. Like, trying to enjoy the fact that that Shohei Ohtani is the greatest baseball player of all time, and seeing something that we've never witnessed before, the fact that it's, like, right in front of us, I feel like the media should really kind of capture that and try to take advantage of what's in front of us today.
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes the older crowd with baseball, they have a hard time accepting that or letting go of that. I think it's a great debate between Koufax and Kershaw.
Yeah.
And you'll never hear an older fan even give Kershaw 1 ounce of credit for being really the Koufax of his generation. But he is. I mean, Kershaw's numbers stack up with anybody. He's got the lowest ERA of all time, going back 100 years, you know, before they changed everything, or when you know, baseball was a lot differently played before 1920. But, you know, I think there are plenty of those players that are here right now, that are special right now. I think Trout was another. You know, what Mike's done, he flies under the radar, I think, some ways. But that is one amazing baseball player that I'm sure stacks up with the others. You know, there's such a hold on the guys of the past, and that's great. And baseball needs that. Willie Mays should be celebrated in that way as the greatest living player, especially as he's getting older, in his 90s now. And, you know, who knows how much more time Willie has here. So he should be celebrated in that way. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that these guys right now today are among the greatest to ever play. And I think that baseball, you know, football's no problem with that. No problem. Nobody's got any problem calling Tom Brady the greatest quarterback ever. Nobody's hanging on Johnny Unitas in that way. Same thing with basketball. There's some pull with Jordan, but we all saw Michael play too. Like, it's not like Michael played 100 years ago. So I think that baseball, for whatever reason, can't let go of the past, and it kind of overshadows how great some of these players are today that could have played in any era.
Yeah. Why do you think that Trout has sort of flown under the radar throughout his career? Is that a product of him playing on the West Coast, a product of him not having playoff success? Is it just the nature of baseball being more of a regional sport even?
Well, I think there's a lot of things at play with Trout specifically. One, I think number one is that he hasn't won. He's won one division championship since he's been there. That was 9 years ago now. They have not won a playoff game since he's been there. It's significant. I think if Trout was on that stage every day and doing amazing things every October, he would be looked at a little bit differently in that regard. There's also a real consistency to Mike. You know, he's not a guy who's hitting 60 homers. He's not driving in 150 runs. He's not winning all these batting titles. He's just consistently really great every single day and every single year. I mean, he's got like an 850 OPS this year, and people are trying to say, well, Mike's cooked. You know, he's got what he's done this year, he's been a really good year. He just hasn't had the type of year that he normally has. But, you know, I think if I looked it up, out of batting average, home runs, and RBIs, the Triple Crown categories, he's led the American League in one of those categories only one time in his career. So he's never been kind of in that conversation. But he's just he's an MVP conversation every year because of the numbers that he stacks up on a daily basis. So I think that's part of it. You know, I think baseball shouldn't be so afraid of regionalizing or however they want to look at it. I mean, yes, they should be more, have a more national appeal, but I think getting away from the, from being regionally strong to have that national appeal, they need to be careful about that.
Did you happen to see the clip of Stephen A. Smith last week staring into an ESPN camera to say that nobody cares about the Angels and they're irrelevant?
Yes.
Did you, do you have any thoughts on that? Are the Angels irrelevant in California?
No, I think the Angels are extremely relevant, especially with Mike and Shohei. I mean, they draw great crowds. You know, Angel Stadium usually has a very good audience there. And I see the attention that these calls get when highlights are out.
Yeah.
You know, Trout and Ohtani both, they do something and the highlights are everywhere. And I think there are some good young – the problem with the Angels this year, they've been so hurt. They've had so many injuries that they really couldn't wrap their arms around two really exciting young players they have. The shortstop, Zach Neto, and their catcher, Logan Ohapi, I think are going to be stars in this game too. They're building a good organization. I think that it's taken some time. Perry Manassian's in his third year as the GM. I think he's got a good idea of where he wants it to go. The Angels need to win. You know, in the previous decade, if you know, this last decade has really been dominated by the Dodgers. The previous decade was all Angels. I mean, they were in the playoffs almost every year. They won the World Series in 2002, and then they were in the playoffs most years up until about 2010. I think 2009, they went to the ALCS and lost to the Yankees, and that was really the last run for Socha's group. So, no, I think there's a tremendous relevance there. There's a good history there. You know, Stephen A is going to say what he wants to say. That's his job. I mean, he's supposed to stir the pot and be controversial and you know, make headlines. And I think he did with that. But I think it speaks to the actual relevance of the Angels that saying something like that made headlines because it was so absurd that it got people to pay attention, that's what he's there for.
Did that like resonate with fans at all? Did they seem to take issue with it?
Yeah, I think I'm sure. Yeah, I think fans, anytime you're some clown on TV says that you're irrelevant, it will stoke the fan base. So of course it will. So yeah, I think there's that Stephen A made some enemies around Angels fans, and I'm sure he doesn't care, and I'm sure they don't care about him either.
I think part of that is a product of just like ESPN, those debate shows don't talk baseball too much until they have to. And then when they have to, you do get some takes like that, where some of it comes from ignorance and some of it comes from just needing to be performative and stir the pot, like you said.
Well, that's great. You know, Shohei puts those conversations on TV. He did it during the World Baseball Classic. He's done it with the kind of season that he's had. He'll continue to do it through the trade deadline and then with his own performance. He's on a similar pace to Judge last year in terms of home run. So if he gets into that conversation where he's going to hit close to 60 homers, then it's gonna spark everything else because he's doing it while also having a season where he's going to strike out at least 200 hitters on the mound. So it's unbelievable. And it's great. If Stephen A. Smith wants to talk about baseball because of Shohei Ohtani, then I think that's a win for the sport.
Did you do an Angels game last year for Apple TV, or was this your first Angels game?
No, the first Apple game I did was the Angels against the Mets on Apple TV last year. I think there was, Steven Nelson had some, he was not feeling well on a particular day, and I was there anyway for Mets Radio. So they kind of asked me to jump in pretty last minute. And, you know, not only did that get me more stuff with Apple, I think it got me on the Angels radar too, a little bit more, you know, being in front of them in that way. So I did do that one last year.
The Apple broadcasts were widely criticized on social media last season. And I think a lot of that was brought on by Apple themselves, just because it did seem like they at the start of the season, they weren't necessarily sure if they wanted to go to the traditional broadcast route or try something different. Did you receive a lot of fan feedback about those broadcasts?
The ones, in general, or the ones that I was on?
The ones you were on.
I think the ones I was on, it was so fleeting. You know, it's one game, and you don't really see the feedback in that way. You know, the game I did toward the end of the year was Albert's 700th home run, and you know, the feedback from that was great. I think people seemed to really like the call, and you know, Cardinal fans, I'm sure, would have liked to hear their broadcast, which is understandable. Other than that, I think you know, the feedback was generally very positive for that, and it was a good moment for Apple TV to end on last season. You know, it was kind of a bumpy road. They didn't, you know, they kind of got, they put everything together late. You know, they didn't really have a large lead in going into this foray. And it wasn't like they knew a year before that this was going to happen. It was kind of put together toward the end of the previous offseason going into the season. So they didn't have a lot of runway to get it going. So they, you know, they put it together the way they thought that they should in that short amount of time. And then they've kind of readjusted since then, now that they've had more time to sit back and look at it. And I think the broadcasts have been really widely viewed as being strong this year. You know, they look great, they sound great. And I think that, you know, I think Apple's in a good spot with where Friday Night Baseball is. And, you know, I kind of feel like it took off from having that moment last year. And what a cool moment to land on, not just for me, but for everybody that was covering that package last year, and for Apple to be involved. You know, they thought they were going to have Judge's 60-second homer last year. Albert was kind of in the back of their mind because he was two home runs away.
Right, he was at 698.
So, you know, the Judge didn't happen, but Albert did, and it was just a cool experience, I think, for everybody to be involved with, and kind of launched Apple as a good baseball product for what has been this season.
Yeah, like you said, I'm sure Cardinals fans would have loved to get it on their local network, but you definitely did that call plenty of justice. Was it organic? Was it rehearsed? Like, did you have something written down for it? How do you prepare for a call like that? And how prepared were you, especially just because he was at 698 going into it? He wasn't at 699.
Yeah, it was. I talked to Howie earlier in the week, and I said, you know, I might land on 700. How would you call it? And he said, just call the home run. You know, you don't know when the home run's going to happen within the game. It could be a huge moment in the game. It could be beside the home run itself. It could be a game tying home run or game winning home run. It could be a long home run. It could be a short home run. So, you know, he said, just kind of react to the call in the moment and don't plan anything, just react. And you know, that was kind of my mindset going in. The only thing I wanted to do, and I actually got to say it just because the way the ball was kind of hit, it was a high and kind of arching home run. So it gave me time to get into it. But I just wanted to say it was 700 as soon as possible. And I kind of said it as it was landing, which was perfect. You know, that was more based on the way the ball was hit, though, than anything else. So it was, you know, earlier in the day, we had a meeting, just kind of as we normally would, to go over the elements and some of the things that we wanted to talk about. And, you know, instead of having kind of conversations over the at-bats, I wanted to make sure we were really clean over the at-bats and just give it a lot of space so that in case he did hit a home run, we were on top of it. And then I said, you know, if he hits 699, which was certainly possible, we'll at least have an at-bat for 700. So we will have eyes on us with the anticipation that he might hit 700. That was the first at bat after 699 that he hit 700. So there was not that buildup, but there was an immediacy to it. And I just said, you know, we just need to be kind of clean as far as not talking over too much, not really taking over that space, because the space needed to be Albert in that moment. And nothing we could say would top, you know, the images of what Albert was doing. So I wanted to call it and get out, and that's what we did. And I thought it worked out really good. I mean, there's probably 90 seconds or so of silence from us in the booth, just kind of absorbing the moment after my call.
Yeah, actually, I think that silence afterwards is great. And I remember hearing you talk about calling Pete Alonso's 53rd home run to set the rookie record. And you similarly mentioned that you wanted to make sure that you said the number early on in the call. And then with Albert's call, I think you actually said 700 twice before getting out of the call.
I think you said it like as it was landing. I said it when it landed that it was his 700th home run. And then I also said that he was part of the 700
part of the 700 club. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was kind of how I led into both. I wanted to have that number in there and then really kind of just let the moment tell the story for itself. And it was cool. It was cool how it all turned out.
How was working with Howie Rose? Did you know much about him before coming to New York?
You know, I didn't really know a lot about him because, you know, I kind of knew who he was and I knew his background. I was familiar with the Mato call and some of his Mets moments. And I liked listening to Howie. When I would listen to, you know, other broadcasts around the league, I would come across Howie every now and then. So I was familiar with him in that regard, but not really with like how iconic he was in New York, you know, not being from there. If people ask, was it intimidating to sit next to Howie? You know, for me, it wasn't because I really wasn't as clear on who he was in terms of to the New York fan base the way that I might have been if I was sitting next to Pat Hughes. I mean, it would have been a lot more intimidating for me to sit next to Pat Hughes growing up in Chicago than it would have been for Howie. But so I think it worked out for me in that way that I was able to be comfortable right away. And, you know, Howie was just – he would have made you comfortable anyway because of how he is and – you know, he's just the best when it comes to mentoring younger announcers. He loves it. And he really makes you feel like it's your spot as much as it is his.
I know you filled in for Gary Cohen on SNY. So you had a bit of a working relationship with the TV booth of the Mets as well. But is there a camaraderie between the radio and TV booths at all?
Oh, yeah, there's tremendously. I mean, you know, Howie knows those guys forever too. You know, it's Gary's known them since his broadcasting days started with the Mets, but so is Howie. I mean, Howie's first time working Mets radio was in 1987. So Keith and Ron were still active, right? And still a big part of it. And, you know, in terms of Howie and Gary, well, they've worked together side by side in some ways since Gary got to the Mets. So I mean, I think that there's almost kind of a Howie and Gary feel like kindred spirits. And you know, it's impossible to not get along with Keith and Ron. I mean, they're just the best. I mean, they're hilarious off the air as they are on it, maybe even more so. And, you know, it's there's plenty of camaraderie built in through Howie's relationships. They're really easy. I mean, for me coming in there, they never treated me like some outsider or like some, you know, somebody who didn't belong or anything like that. I mean, they were always very welcoming. I remember the first time I filled in for Gary on Mets TV, it was a spring training game. Bill Webb had just passed away, I think the day before. It was the first broadcast after Bill Webb passed away. So it was emotional for Keith and Ron. And, you know, I was kind of just in that situation working this. Even if it was a spring training game, you still have the enormity of that broadcast on you. And filling in for Gary is not an easy task. And I was surprised by how easy Keith and Ron made it and how much they let me kind of lead the way like they would for Gary. And it really made me comfortable instantly working with them. I love working with them. I think they're two of the best analysts. You know, I don't think Keith gets enough credit for how good of an analyst he is. And I certainly Ronnie does. But Keith's a tremendous baseball analyst in regard to without even thinking about all the funny stuff that he says and what a wild card he is in the booth. He really tells the story of the game well too.
Yeah.
So I loved working with them. I'd love to do it again. They're great.
How does the cadence of radio compare to TV and just the different way of calling a game on the two platforms?
I think that, you know, radio, you there's no real moment to let it breathe necessarily yet. You have to really be in it at all times, describing things. I haven't really done radio since they put the pitch timer in. So I'm sure it's even quicker now and you feel more rushed to get, you know, to describe everything. TV, I think there's just a breeziness to it. You know, with with having the pictures for you, you can really just kind of let it go the way you want it to. So it's a little bit easier kind of to work through TV, in my opinion.
Do you like the pitch clock?
Yeah, I think it would be crazy not to. You know, I think the pitch clock has been a huge thing. You know, it's the biggest thing to me is how the fans have reacted to it, because, you know, the fans, I think, would all, no matter what kind of game it was, no matter what the score was, there was a breaking point for fans with regard to how long they were in the ballpark. Maybe they have kids, maybe they have a job they need to go to, maybe they have dinner plans if it's a day game. There was always that kind of cutoff that fans would leave and the ballpark would be nearly empty in a lot of cases at the end of the game, which is supposed to be like the peak, you know, how does the game end? What's the end result? And I think now with the pitch timer, fans are there till the end of the game. And I think that's the biggest difference, is at the end of the game, when the result is determined, that everybody's there and they're reacting to it. And I think that makes for just a better overall entertainment aspect of the product, is a lot better just from having the fans there in the ninth inning.
I know we started with the All-Star game, but last night they do so many in-game interviews, which they do on national broadcasts now, a lot of in-game interviews. They have players mic'd up. Is that something that, as an announcer, does it get in the way of calling the game at all?
Not to me, because I think that part of it, you know, we had a really good one with Carlos Correa on Apple earlier this year, and we've had a couple others that have been pretty good, but not quite the Correa one. Just the timing worked out too. It was kind of a longer inning, and he Miles Straw reached base. They used to be teammates, so he kind of had part of that conversation. I think that kind of lane into what's happening on the field and getting to know the players in that way, I think is huge. So I think it's a big enhancement to the broadcast within the game. I think the sport needs more of it. I think these players should be mic'd up all the time, because baseball really gives you an opportunity to converse and play at the same time. And the other sports don't have that. And if you're trying to get players to get me more known, I think sticking a microphone on them and having them interact, whether it's just amongst themselves or within the broadcast, really allows players to have, you know, a branding opportunity and a marketing opportunity that the other sports can't give you.
Is it hard to kind of ingratiate yourself to a new fan base, like Gary Cohen and Howie Rose? Everybody knows they grew up diehard Mets fans. Michael Kay was always a Yankees fan. Mike Breen grew up a Knicks fan. John Sterling, however, did not grow up a Yankees fan. Is it weird or hard being the voice of a team when you grew up watching another team? Do fans even know that you grew up as a Cubs fan?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if they do or don't. I think they know I'm not from there. You know, it'd certainly be easier to at least know the franchise. I got to know the Mets pretty well. I mean, I was sitting next to a walking history book of Mets encyclopedia every day. So I think that certainly helped brush up on my Mets knowledge. And I, you know, just from being a baseball fan and a Cubs fan, the Cubs played the Mets a lot when I was a kid. They were still in the same division. So there was a familiarity there anyway. But yeah, I think it's a little different. The Angels, an American League team. I didn't watch the American League as much. I didn't have much of a deep knowledge of their history, at least not the way that I think you should for this type of role. So I'm learning it, and I'm going to know a lot more after this season is over and after the off season is over. So I think going into next year, I'll have a better handle on all that too. But I think if you have a good process about how you prepare, and if you have a good way of presenting the information and presenting your broadcast, that it could fit anywhere. Like I now feel like I can go to any team and fit in and learn their history and learn what's important to their fans and tell those stories through that lens. If I was doing the Cubs, would it be a lot easier? Yeah. I mean, the stories I could tell are different because I lived it. You know, I lived through Sean Dunstan's career. I could give you a lot more flavor and color with regard to that. But you know, I think you can still do an impactful job just by reading and researching and learning how to present that what you have read and researched into your broadcast.
Are you still friendly with Joe Davis? I know you both kind of grew up in the minors a bit together, I'm sure 15 years ago or whatever. You guys would have eagerly signed up to be the voices of the Angels and the Dodgers.
Yeah, we talk about it a lot, you know, how funny it is that we're the two LA TV baseball voices. It's funny how that's worked out, because we were really in pretty much the same spot when we started our careers in the Southern League. I'm a couple of years older, so I was there first, and I was in Mobile, Alabama, and Joe was in Montgomery, Alabama. So they were the two closest teams basically to each other in the league. And so they played each other a lot, and they were in the same division, and Joe and I became friends pretty much right away as he entered the league, and we've been friends ever since. And you know, I think for each other, we've been a good ear and a good eye for how we feel like our careers should be going, or how we are sounding on a particular broadcast. And you know, I'm extremely proud of Joe and happy for him that he's been able to take it to on a national level the way that he has. I mean, doing the All-Star game, doing the World Series, you know, in addition to the Dodger job, it's ridiculous. And it doesn't seem even, it's surreal to both of us that we've gotten into these positions the way that we have, and from where we started. And I think, yeah, if you would have told us that 11, 12 years ago when we were in the Southern League together, we would have gotten a good chuckle out of your crystal ball. But it's been good, and I'm over the moon for Joe and Adam Amin too. I mean, we kind of knew him from that same time frame, and the same way that he's put. I'm just glad I've kind of caught up in a little bit of regard, because they were their rise in this industry was so absurd, it was so meteoric, so kind of unusual. So it's fun to see them having the careers that they're having, and you know, to be in that conversation in any way with them.
And then your cousin is Major League umpire Tony Randazzo. And at Awful Announcing, announcers complaining about umpires or refs is like gold for headlines for us. So if you have anything that you want to criticize your cousin about, that would be great. But have you called games that he was working before?
Yes. Yeah. Quite a few. You know, it's just whatever the rotation works out. He was around the Mets, and now he'll be around the Angels too. It's funny, you know, I go at the umpires a little bit, and you know, but when he's there, I always say he makes the greatest calls ever. I put him over in a big way. So it's I won't criticize him. You know, if he did do something that cost the Angels in a game that he umpired, I'd try to find some avenue to make it seem like it was somebody else's fault.
And then last thing, respecting the fact that the jobs are currently filled, do you want to get back to Chicago? Is that the ultimate goal, or are you happy on the West Coast now?
I mean, I love where I'm at. It's a great place to be. You know, it's beautiful there, and you know, where I live in Orange County is a cool spot. I'm in Chicago right now for the All-Star break. I still live in Chicago in the off season. It'll always be home. Every single family member I have is in the Chicago area. So, you know, it'll always be home, but there's always a spot here for me, whether that's on the air or not. You know, I'm comfortable and happy in California, and very fortunate that the places I've been for most of my career have been New York, Chicago, and out Southern California. It's been a great ride. It would almost feel weird to not be in a big city now and not be in a big market. I don't even know how I would handle that, because I've been attached to these big markets for so long. So I've just been really fortunate to have these opportunities, and that they've worked out the way that they have. And I hope I'm with the Angels for a long time.
Wayne, you were great. Thanks. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
All right, Brandon. Thanks a lot.
That is Wayne Randazzo. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Please rate and subscribe this podcast. Please also subscribe to Awful Announcing's YouTube page. But regardless of how you consume Awful Announcing and the Awful Announcing Podcast, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.